had their offices in Chicago. The first big shipment that came along, where they were shipping a labor gang out to work on the Northern Pacific Railroad. I went in and paid the shark my $2 and...
were picked up by, you were hired by the shark to go out on the Southern Pacific.
Northern Pacific. We were supposed to go all the way out to Missoula, Montana on this labor shipment. But of course, the subject of conversation the first night in the car, the three or four cars that they, chair cars that they had on this Northern Pacific trade, on this Chicago Northwestern Railroad, where do we get off? In other words, with rare exception, there were very few of the migratory workers that were supposed to be enlisted for this labor shipment. They didn't have the faintest idea of going on to Missoula, Montana, and most of them to work for that outfit. What they were interested in, like myself, was getting out as far west as they could to the point of where they figured they would be able to do better for themselves on their own. And that's just exactly what I did. About 200 miles east of Missoula, Montana, when I picked out a nice country town, I dropped off the train and let the train go on without me. And there were about maybe a baker's dozen of my fellow workers did the same thing. So there I was. The only thing I knew how to do was to sell my labor power. So I went to work out in some of the farms out there. They called them ranches out in that part of the country. And before I knew it, I was a cowpoke and a fence fixer and a roustabout and riding herd on about 150 steers, taking care of a half a dozen horses at the same time. I'd never met a horse before in my life, except of course out in Lincoln Park at times. But then I began to hear rumors. I met some of the boys who were members of the Industrial Workers of the World. And at that time, I think that was in 1909, that was when the free speech fight was going on in Missoula, Montana. So, of course, I had to find out what it was all about. I wasn't a member of the Industrial Workers of the World at the time, but I wanted to find out what this bunch of militant workers were doing, what it all meant. I had a kind of a general feeling of class consciousness, but I didn't know exactly what the score was. When I got to Missoula, Montana, and I saw the rough way that the minions of the law and some of those deputy sheriffs and some of the bloodcloth mob, the way they handled those fellows, I said to myself, well, this is no place for Harry. The first thing you know, you're going to get into a beef and you're going to use that well-known direct action on somebody, and then you're going to be in real trouble. At that time,
did your parents have any radical history or any?
My father was a member of the Upholsterers Union, a good AFL craft union. Dad, of course, believed in the old baloney, that Samuel Gompers and all the other labor fakers put out. Fair day's work for a fair day's pay, and he accepted the capitalist system as a finality. But when I heard about these chaps that were in the IWW and with their ideas that it would be possible to have a world where people who work for a living would really be rulers of their own destinies, and that we could have a free society that would be based on the idea that the worker would receive the full benefits of his labor, I said to myself, well, that's the outfit for me.
So you said it was in Chicago during the Haymarket?
My father was there at the time that the Haymarket riot took place, but poor Dad, of course, he didn't know what the score was, but undoubtedly his sympathies were with the Haymarket martyrs. I can remember Dad saying it was a terrible thing that those men were hanged. He said they came from a country where they were much more, in Dad's opinion, a great deal more oppressed than the workers were in this country here. And he said it was only natural. I can remember Dad saying that it was only natural that with a chance to express themselves in a more freer way, that they made an attempt to correct some of what they thought were the maladjustments and the bad working conditions that Dad found and other workers found among the workers.
Who was the first IWW that you met or influenced you? Was it a person?
James Wilson. I met him on the road. I think he's mentioned in that proceedings of the, wasn't it the 13th convention, and Ben, that you left with Herb?
Yes, Ben's got a copy of, I don't remember what the convention number was. 1912.
Oh, 1912 or 13?
13.
Anyways, Bill,
yeah.
James Wilson was one of those whom I first met. When I was on the, from Missoula, Montana, I started beating my way out west over the Chicago, Milwaukee, and Pacific Railroad. At that time, they were building an extension on the Chicago, Milwaukee, and Pacific Railroad, and I worked as a spike mauler, and I worked as a teamster, and I did a little Gandhi dancing on the Chicago, Milwaukee, and Pacific Railroad as far all the way out to the Pacific Coast. That's how I happened to get out to the Puget Sound.
You were still 18 or 19?
I was just about 18 years old at that time. And then when I reached Tacoma and I met James Wilson again, and several of the other chaps, whose name I can't recall, in Tacoma, Washington, in Spokane, Washington, Gurley Flynn at that time was holding a series of lectures in the IWW Hall, and I think it was in Spokane that I took out a card in the IWW. Then I beat my way from Spokane to Tacoma, and then we got together, James Wilson and some of the other old-timers there, and we organized Local 380 of the Marine Transport Workers Local. We were doing pretty well there on the front there and signing up seamen and the longshoremen when the old I Lose Again outfit, the ILA, stepped in and, of course, claimed jurisdiction, and then, of course, it was a battle between we fellows who held the industrial union idea and the craft union fakers. And our members who held control of a certain number of the docks were, they used to, the Northern Pacific unloaded coal, and also the dock where the Blue Funnel Line steamers came in. They even went in there, the ILA members, and scabbed on us. They even worked for lower wages than what the IWW men were getting. We were holding out at that time for $3 a day, for a 9-hour day. But the ILA, presumably union men, they even were willing to work below the scale in order to root us fellows up.
Are we gonna say this? Go ahead, it's
up. Well, I just wanted to call your attention to the ILA,
I also want to call your attention that both Ben and Abe don't call them Elizabeth Gurley Flynn. It's always Gurley Flynn. You said that.
Just Gurley.
You know, the only people who ever call her Elizabeth, I guess, were the old socialists way back in the older days. They used to call her Elizabeth and call her Gurley.
So what happened to this? There must have been a terrific struggle on the docks there.
Well, the ILA, they practically scabbed the longshoreman branch of the industrial workers out of existence in Tacoma. The only ones that we had left who held the charter on the wall were, of course, the men that were going to sea. I managed to eke out an existence on the front. I longshored and whenever the blue funnel steamers came in, once in a while, because I had a Scandinavian-sounding name, why, I'd worked the Pacific Coast steamers, you know, the Admiral ships. And at that time, the ILA, except that that was one of the things that we made a strong fight against in Tacoma, was this idea, you know, of the shape-up. Like you had here in San Francisco and in Portland and Tacoma and in Washington, where if a ship was to be unloaded, you shaped up whenever the ship was announced as being officially docked, and then the foreman, you know, the different gangs would pick his particular gang, you know. Well, because my name was a Scandinavian-sounding name, Jensen, why, there was one big longshoreman foreman by the name of, with a good Scandinavian name of Swanson. Why, when he reached my name, he'd say, "All right, Jensen, you go down in hatch number 3. So I managed to eke out an existence, and then, of course, in between jobs, why, I took whatever labor happened to come along. I never was able to break into on the Northern Pacific Railroad as a car repairs helper, you know, the same as Bill Foster worked. But when they found out that I carried a red card, why, they tossed me out. In other words, the way Ben so truly put it, you'd bore from within, you kept on boring, but you found yourself on the outside again. That's what happened to me when I joined that Mount Hood Lodge of the Brotherhood of Railroad Carmen of America. I just bored in and bored my way right through and came out on the other side. They just
still,
tossed.
But you're still in the Electricians Union.
Not by choice. give them time. They'll get around to it, probably.
You're in the Electricians Union now?
I'm afflicted with the AFL, yeah.
So you're an AFL man, yeah.
But,
aren't there more electricians in the UE now than there are left in
the
house?
No, that's the electricians.
Oh.
That's in the factories, you know, the UE.
Oh, I see.
Not the building trade.
The industry.
So about that time, why, let's see, that was in the fall, I believe, of 1910. I think it was in the month of August that the free speech fight really started going good down in Fresno. Our paper, Solidarity and the Industrial Worker, I was at that time appealing for more volunteers, more recruits, you know, for the fact that we're going on for free speech down in Fresno. I and some of the other fellow workers, we talked the thing over and decided it was our duty to go down to sunny California and lend them a hand. So we went down one night to the to the Northern Pacific Railroad Station when the North Coast Limited roared on its way. No, I mean when the crack train of the SP rather roared on its way while we were riding with it. I beat my way all the way.
The cushions, Harry?
Hmm?
The cushions?
Oh, yeah. Decidedly.
Not a freight train.
Not.
Blind baggage or something?
Blind baggage on the rods any way you could. And I beat my way on the SP to Ashland, Oregon. I got ditched off of one of their crack trains, I remember. And in Ashland, Oregon, I found some of the boys, some of the IWW men that were sort of jungling up, and we recombined our forces and started on our way again. I had a terrific battle to get down to Fresno. Several times I almost made the bucket while I was trying to get down there. I remember, you know, they... The deputy sheriffs. The deputy sheriffs and the local gendarmes all along the line had been given the word to frisk everybody that they found riding on boxcars or on the passenger trains, and if they found the red card on them, why, to throw them in the what the Spaniards call the cartel. The jail.
Oh, that's a wonderful.
So I made the bucket. I think it was in Modesta. I got one of the SP railroad bulls picked me up, and he kept marveling to him, to the other fellow who was with him, this other stupid-looking jerk. He said, "I don't see why you fellows want to make the bucket." He said, "That county jail in Fresno." He said, "We got a much better jail here," he said, "in Modesta." He couldn't understand that there was a question of principle involved, you know.
You told him where you were going?
Sure.
They knew where they were.
Oh, well, everyone was going.
So he says, "I don't know what it's all about," but he says, "We don't want you here," he says. "Get the hell out of the town," he says. We don't care where you go, north, east, south, or west," he says. "Don't stick around Modesta." So eventually I dropped off of a train in Fresno, and at that time, what was the name, Herb, of that, you recall a socialist by the name of George Barr? Barr? Or Bear?
There was a cartoonist there.
Well, anyways, there was an old-time socialist party man, a real old-timer, you know, an old farmer that had a farm on the outskirts of Fresno, and I guess he had just enough of the old fighting socialist spirit that when they refused, first we had a free speech, we had a headquarters, you know, in the IWW Hall in Fresno. But eventually, why, Chief Shaw and the chief of police and his deputies and the rest of the broadcloth mob, they drove us out of the hall, closed the hall up. So this old socialist, he said we were welcome to make our headquarters or free speech fighters on his farm.
On the labor unit.
So he placed a big tent, a great big army tent, at our disposal, and that's where we had our recruiting station for the free speech fighters. We had Koch, you know, and Jack White, who later on took a prominent part in the San Diego free speech fight. He was our chef. He had one of the best cooks that was to be found on the Pacific coast, you know, Ben, doing the cooking for us. Yeah. And I don't know if you remember him or not.
I don't remember him, but I'll never forget his speech.
I quoted it 1,000 times.
Yeah?
To hell with your courts, I know what justice is.
I'm Jewish, now that rings a bell in my memory, too.
When they sentenced him in San Diego, the judge asked him if he had anything to say before he went to jail. So he made a speech, which is a classic. I've got a copy of it. You can have it. So from then on, we were
but
all
used
to quote.
I know what justice
we is. Quoted Jack White, and in the Etta Giovanitti campaign, that was a favorite quote because we were telling the workers in New England that Etta and Giovanitti were being framed to send them to the electric chair, and we didn't expect that we would get any justice in the courts. So that's the kind of campaign we carried on. We opened up with the hell with your courts. I know what justice is.
Tell Irene I'll be there tomorrow night, not to worry, but my manager.
Well,
you know that I look upright, but you're the
one. Yeah, I will.
So, Jack White.
Ate a big dinner. You're
I'll see you. I know be here for when I get home anyway.
I imagine.
Yeah.
If this keeps up, it's going to be wonderful.
Could I ask if anyone is. I know, Harry, you like orange juice before the show, so do you want me to get some orange juice? Does anyone like any soft
drinks?
Is that winding up?
Orange juice, if anybody else is in favor of the motion.
Okay, so long as you don't spike it with vodka.
Oh, okay.
No, that's
both of Berkeley,
that's
they gave me some orange juice spiked with vodka.
Isn't that, yeah?
I don't know, I don't know of a better way of desiccating or
the Russians don't drink it in orange juice.
No,
I mean
Herbal had to tell you the funny story. When he was in Germany, he celebrated VE Day with some Russian wounded prisoners of war. They were the officers, you know, in a filthy, dirty hospital. Well, I have a letter. It should be published. And they went over there too. They didn't even know it was VE Day. They went over there, he and a few other progressives that he had met, actually got over to Europe in the army, to give these guys candy bars and cigarettes and things. So, oh boy, they just glommed onto these Americans and they said to get some more. So, Herb and his phone went back. And this fellow, this friend that he had met was in New York who spoke German, and most of the Russians spoke German, so he was an interpreter. So they went back down to the place and got some more of the GIs, and they went back and Herbert was saying in this letter how hospitable they were. They here they had they were in this filthy. I don't remember just exactly how many wounded prisoners there had been in this hospital. These were officers who were treated better than the ordinary soldiers, and I guess half of them had died during the course of their internment in this hospital. But anyway, they had this great big long table. They put clean newspapers on it, and they brought out all their delicacies. This was VE Day, so they had gotten jam. And each American GI, there was, 10 or 12 of these kids, guys, and each one had an officer in back of them, you know, being his personal servant. And they had vodka. And Herbert writes this.
Not vodka, alcohol.
Alcohol. All that.
Liberated from the Germans.
Alcohol. And Herbert said he wanted to cut his down with water. And just as soon as he'd take a sip, I'd put water in it. And this captain, Red Army captain, was back and would pour more alcohol. And you just men didn't put water in their drinks.
Every once in a while, they'd say, "George." And I turned around and he had a teaspoonful of jam.
jam to them, you know, that was a rare delicacy. Well, Americans don't eat jam, you know, that was nothing to them. And they toasted, all the toast they had, of course they all got roaring drunk, incidentally. And they sang.
Musicians and violinists.
And they, what was the song they sang?
Oh, yeah. Rosemary. One violinist there was a great one. He had managed to hang on to his violin. One of the greatest ones I ever heard. I don't know who he was. He played.
But this drinking, see? A man.
We better get back to Fresno, honey.
It wasn't Goldberg, was it, the violinist?
No, this was a Russian.
They were really two-fisted drinkers.
Yeah.
They did. But they eat a lot. They have a lot of fish and cheese and jam.
I went to the one of the Russian embassy parties when I was in New York last spring. It was for the after Nishinsky died.
Mm-hmm.
It was for the new representative, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It was for the newspaper people, and they had this vodka. And to me, I mean, I had never tasted it before, but it was just like white mule, old Missouri. And I couldn't see any difference.
Well, a Scotsman should be right at home in vodka land then, Ben.
Yeah, that's what it is.
Yeah, you know, when the Scots
like
celebrate St. Andrew's Day.
You know,
what your people originally came from La Belle France, didn't they?
My mother's
I knew Ben for years now,
and my mother was an old
didn't know he was
from County Cork.
Well, anyways,
he has a slight Irish
The other day I was talking Irish all day long because I was putting out advertising for
sure
the Irish.
Sure, now how did you learn it?
Okay, now we're on the air again. Okay, well, let's go back to the free speech. Well, I started to ask you when we were interrupted about Jack White. He was there and cooking for the boys, huh?
Mm-hmm.
When they were in the camp out at this old socialist ranch out there.
Yeah.
And how many were in jail already?
Well, at that time, our forces were at a rather low ebb. Ben.
What?
And it was only when, at that time, that was when Frank Little and Harry McClintock, maybe you remember him, Radio Mac. And,
I heard about him just the other day, he's around here.
And Ed Collins. And there was a Frenchman who had a name a good deal similar to yours, I can't remember. Anyways, these were the men who were the general staff, the ones that were planning the strategy of the thing when I drifted into the free speech fighters camp. And I remember the threat had been going around, Ben, on the part of the agricultural farm leaders, you know, the bankers and the officialdom, and the broadcloth mob, that if we didn't get the Hades out of Fresno, that they were going to make a mass assault on our free speech fighters camp and were going to drive us out at the point of, you know, shotguns and pick handles. So of course you can imagine how well that went with the boys, and I remember distinctly that particular night when the Fresno Republican carried this intelligence, you know, this news, why the boys with Frank Little acting as the chairman decided that we would answer their challenge by a challenge of our own. In other words, we were going to take the fight up where it had been sort of left behind, you know, and we were going to resort to the only weapon that we could use, passive resistance. In other words, it was decided that night by a unanimous vote. There were only about 24 of us at the time in the free speech fighters camp. We decided that we would go downtown the next night and pick out a street corner, each one for himself, and notably the plaza in Fresno, And each one would start speaking and defy the ban that had been placed on free speech, you know, by the city fathers and by the chief of police.
Each one of you in a separate spot?
Each one of the idea, the strategy in back of the ban was each one was to wait until, if I was the first one who made a speech or tried to make a speech, the other boys were, the other fellow workers were supposed to wait until the minions of the law had picked me off, and then when they were on their way to jail with the victim, why then the other fellow worker would take up where I left off. So that was the strategy that we played right from the start. In other words, to make the free speech fight as extensive as possible, each one of us would pick out a spot all of his own. I picked the plaza, and I guess I must have been about the 15th one that made the cartel that night. Anyways, I waited until the chief of police and the cops had hauled this other fellow off to the jailhouse, and then I got up and I spoke my little piece. I only got as far as the First Amendment of the Constitution of the United States states in unequivocal language that cannot be misunderstood: Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech or of the press or of the people to peaceably assemble and petition their government for redress of grievances. That was as far as I got. About that time, there was a big 200-pound deputy bore down on me, and he shook me like a terrier, and before I knew it, I was on my way to the patrol wagon, on my way to the county jail in Fresno. Well, there were, at that time, when I made the bucket, I think there must have been about 20 of the boys of our original 24, and there were four of them that held out on us. It was good strategy, because the next night they waited until the second night of the speech, the renewal of the free speech fight men, and then they started making their talks downtown. Well, gradually more recruits kept drifting in, and the same thing was repeated, you know, the same strategy of making their speeches and being hauled off to jail, and eventually it resulted in there being about 105 of our boys being in the county jail in Fresno. They had the jail so full where they put most of us in the bullpen. They tried isolating some of our leaders, but we raised so much Hades, and they raised such a clamor about it, and everybody staged a sit down and a hunger strike combined, and made themselves so obnoxious to the jailers that they finally took our leaders and put them back in the bullpen where we wanted them. And Frank Little, of course, was right in them. He was our commanding officer. He was the one, you know, who planned the grand strategy of the fight almost all the way through, with, of course, old-timers like Jack White and Ed Collins and Harry McClintock and some of the other ones, assisting. So eventually it reached the stage where, as I said, they had about 105 of us in the jail, and by that time they were at their wits' ends as to what to do with the thing. At that time, the Fresno Republican, which was the chief organ of reaction in Fresno, was saying that now they had found a way that would be very effective in dealing with the I won't works, as the stupid morons called the boys. They were going to put us on the rock pile, but before the thing ever came to a head of where they actually started putting us on the rock pile, Somebody, one of the jailers one night, made the big mistake of abusing one of the boys verbally and attempting to pull him out of the bullpen, and naturally we wouldn't stand for a thing like that, and the result was there was war right inside the jail between we fellows that were in the bullpen and the jailer and his deputies on the outside of the bullpen. They attempted to turn a small fire hose on us that they had hanging up on the wall, but we in turn captured the fire hose from them and turned it on them. Well, of course, by that time they really were alarmed, and the first thing we knew, why, somebody shouted, "Look out, here it comes, they're bringing in the fire hose." And sure enough, here they had the brave fire laddies from the Fresno Fire Department standing up at the top of the stairs leading down into the bullpen, and they turned the 4-inch fire hose in on us fellows in the bullpen. Well, I guess almost anybody can understand the force of a 4-inch fire hose. In no time at all, why, everything there was in the bullpen, including ourselves, were floating off on a stream of water all the way back to the end of the bullpen. We built a barricade out of mattresses and boxes and chairs and what have you, and behind this barricade, well, we plugged the water main so that the water kept rising in the bullpen. With the idea in mind, our strategy was that if we kept the water rising in the bullpen, eventually it would reach, it would start to seep over and flood the storeroom out, which was underneath the stairs where they were turning the fire hose, where they kept their bacon and beans and other food supplies and blankets and mattresses and that. And the strategy really worked, because eventually the water in the bullpen was up to our knees, and when they saw that it was beginning to flood their storeroom, why, then they the sheriff decided to call it off. But there was another factor involved in calling off the 4-inch fire hose too. At 12 o'clock at midnight on that same night that they were turning the fire hose in on us, a new sheriff took office. And 1 minute after 12, he stepped in and took command of the situation. And he walked in and he said, "Cut it out." And he says, "Turn off that hose." And then we thought at first, you know, that he was one of the enemy, but he had a loud, resonant sounding voice, and he called out, "Wait a minute, boys, wait a minute." He said, "I have a message to deliver to you." So new sheriff took office at 12 o'clock. Originally, he wouldn't have taken office until the next day. But because of the fact that they were, you know, that there was this so-called riot going on in the jail, he took advantage of the fact that legally his office began at 12 o'clock at midnight. And he took command of the situation. And he told the jailer and the head jailer and his minions to turn the fire hose off. And then he made a little speech to our boys. And he said, "Boys, I don't want you to think that I had anything to do with this disgraceful proceedings that took place tonight." He said, "I'm the new sheriff," and he said, "ordinarily I wouldn't take office until the day following, but," he said, in view of what I knew," he said, "what they told me what was going on here," he said, "from now on," he said, "all these fellows," he said, "including this man here," and he pointed to the head jail and the rest of them, he said, "they're under my jurisdiction," he said. "I'm the one that's giving orders around here." And he said, "I'll tell you what, boys," he said, "if you fellows," he said, "will help us clean up this thing," he said, I think we can come to some kind of a compromise, some kind of an understanding." So naturally, you know, with a chap like that who seemed to prepared to give us a halfway decent break, why, we proceeded to follow out the hint that he threw up out. We even let some of the despised old trustees come into the bullpen, you know, and help us clean the thing up. They gave us mops, and we cleaned and swept the water into the drains, you know, and everything was in a horrible mess. The blankets and our mattresses and our personal belongings, our clothing and everything was soaking wet. So this new sheriff, about 2 o'clock in the morning, why, lo and behold, why, he had the trustees and some of the jailers, they brought down about 50 new blankets and mattresses, and they brought them into the bullpen, and we spread these new mattresses and these blankets out, and there wasn't enough for everybody, but we slept in rotation, you know, Ben. You know, that is, while some of the boys slept, the other ones would busy themselves in some other way, you know. We were playing cards and singing songs and having a heck of a good time, you know. Now that we knew that we had the feeling at that time that we were well on to the way to victory. So
did
this
you have
new
any chess players in the.
Oh, undoubtedly, Jack White was a real chess player, and yeah. So,
that's where I learned to play.
Oh, Jerome, you know, is one of the great chess players. You know, DJ Jerome.
Yeah.
So the new sheriff, he wasn't very enthusiastic about the rock pile idea, man. But he said, well, he practically talked it over with our board of directors, you know, with our. We had a regular committee, a strategy of.
You had a board of directors.
You know, a regular board of strategy board. He talked it over with Frank Little and some of the other ones, and he said, "Well," he said, "there's two things you fellows can do." He said, "You can make idiots out of yourselves." He said, "You can go out there," he said, "and refuse to work on the rock pile." He said, "If you take a tip," he said, "from me, boys," he says, "you'll go out there and do as little as you can." Well, that was just exactly the same kind of advice that our leaders handed out to us. So to the great disappointment of the city fathers and all the opposition, when they opened up the rock pile, instead of the boys refusing to work and then being put on a bread and water diet, why, we went out on the rock pile, but I can assure you, Ben, that I never saw men that worked with less enthusiasm than there was alleged iron workers on the rock pile. I think we worked on the rock pile of something like about 20 days, and in that time the amount of rock that we had crushed, I don't think it would have extended from that door over to the wall there.
What kind of a person was Frank Little?
Hmm?
What kind of a person was Frank Little?
Prisoner?
Person.
Oh, Frank was one of nature's noble men. I'll never forget that man. He was half Cherokee Indian, and you could see in that he bore himself, you might say, in the same way that one that an Indian chief would, you know. And he had a very commanding figure, and with that. He had those sort of eyes, you know, that you could never forget, if you get what I mean. In other words, he was a man that had a commanding sort of an appearance and a commanding sort of a personality. If you once met the man, you could never forget him. And Frank was, you might say, the one who very largely planned the strategy of the free speech fight in Fresno from beginning to end.
And he was the leader in jail, pretty much.
He was the leader in jail, pretty much, too. Of course, everything, we did everything in a democratic sort of a way, in line with the traditions of our organization. In other words, The committee never did anything on its own. It was always subject to veto, you know, by the rank and file. But after they attempt to put the IWW men on the rock pile and make a paying proposition out of it, the way the city fathers and the chief of police and the bankers and the agriculturalists and so on found that it wouldn't work, why gradually we began to receive hints from the Grapevine Telegraph that the other side wanted to compromise the issue. So at the time that we finally succeeded in reaching a compromise, and you might say winning a partial victory in our fight for free speech, at that time the IWW had recruited something like about 150 or 200 members that were supposed to be on their way to Fresno from Portland and from Spokane and as far away as Missoula, Montana, and even from Minneapolis. And when some of the opposition, the reactionaries, when they received that intelligence, when they found that that was the way the thing was going, why, it wasn't but a very short time before our leaders received a notice that the city fathers, that the board of supervisors or aldermen or whatever they were wanted to and the mayor wanted to talk the thing over. So at a rank and file meeting of all the boys in the bullpen, we nominated a committee. Well, as we held a mass meeting of all the free speech fighters in the bullpen the night that we received the news that was given to us by the via the sheriff, the new sheriff, that the city fathers and the mayor wanted to talk the thing over, maybe with the idea in mind of reaching some kind of an understanding of the issues involved. So we appointed a committee, and of course the men who were respected the most and the men whom we trusted the most, Frank Little and Jack White and Harry McClintock and I forget the names of some of the other ones, they were on the committee. So they were given a proper kind of an escort, a very polite escort in contradistinction to the one that we got when we first hit the bullpen. They were taken over to the city hall and they talked the thing over with the mayor and the city fathers, and the result was a compromise was reached. They agreed that the boys would be allowed, that our members would be allowed to speak on the plaza, and that at certain downtown corners that our committee designated as being the proper ones for us to speak on. So the committee brought the report back to the members, and by a now almost unanimous vote, why, we decided to accept the terms that the opposition had offered us, the peace terms. And the next day, why, they opened up the sheriff and his deputies opened up the jail doors and told us we were at liberty to leave any time that we felt like. So some of us took our time about leaving, you know. We thought it'd be a good idea to jungle up, as they call it, you know, and get clean and boil our clothes and took the last bath and the last look around, you know, before we left. Well, you know, we had been in that bullpen from, let's see, I think the speech fight had restarted November the 10th in 1910, and we finally achieved our victory. I think it was in March the 10th of 1911. It was about one of the longest free speech fights, I think. I don't know whether they... I think the San Diego free speech fight was longer than that. But anyways, I decided to leave myself, along with several of the other fellows, about the third or fourth day after they...
Did they feed you while you stayed there?
Oh, sure. Well, we were practically running the jail by that time. That was the difference between the industrial workers of the world. They were, the way they put it in their preamble, by organizing industrially, we are building the structure of the new society within the shell of the old. That's one of the things, you know, that makes the industrial workers of the world unique as a labor organization, was the fact when they asked, when the old sheriff wanted to know one day, who are you leaders? We shouted back, we're all leaders. They could never understand that. A labor organization could be democratically, you know, run. They were so used to having, if they did have any trouble, labor trouble, they'd always call in the labor fakers, you know. The AFL and or the Railroad Brotherhood leaders, and they were the ones that settled
the
issue.
Did you have classes while
you were... Oh, classes in economics, classes in singing. Some of the... Harry McClintock, Radio Mac, had managed to smuggle in his steel guitar. We used to all gather around and sing the... our song.
Radio Mac at the time you were last here, before that, and up to, 10 years or so, was a great favorite in the radio here.
Is that
singing
so?
All the old Wobbly songs.
Is that so?
He was in it.
I jungled up with Radio Mac after the Fresno Free Speech Fight. We had a shack there in Fresno, and for a while all of us were pretty well on our uppers, as the English say. We were, you know, we couldn't get any of them. Frank Little and none of the boys, with rare exception, were able to even get a nod from any of the employers around Fresno because of all they...
What songs did you sing there?
What
songs did you sing there?
Oh, we sang all our old rebel songs and a good many of the other, the Radio Mac. He seems to be a natural when it comes to songs. I can remember he knew about 300 different songs, just purely from memory.
What songs did you sing there?
The Red Flag.
The People's Flag is Deepest Red.
It's shrouded oft our martyred dead. And ere their limbs grew stiff and cold, their lifeblood dyed its every fold. Then raised the scarlet standard high, beneath its foes we live and die. Come dungeons dark or gallows grim, the song shall be our parting hymn.
That's one of the most beautiful songs ever.
Shrouded oft our martyred den, and there their limbs grew stiff and cold, their life blood died its every foam. Raised the scarlet standard high, beneath his foes we live and die. No cowards flinch and traitors sneer, we'll keep the red flag flying here.
That's one of the most beautiful things.
You ever read Sinclair singing Jailbirds to play?
No,
that's the San Diego free speech fight, right?
Absolutely.
Is that coming out of that?
He's travel around the coast with us.
Oh.
Jailbird.
And what else did you sing there? Was Joe Hillsong, did you have that there?
Well, personally, there were only two or three favorites of Joe Hill's that I really cared for. One of them was The Preacher and the Slave.
Yeah.
And, let's see, he wrote another song that was really good. Huh?
That's
good.
What about The Rebel Girl? Didn't he write that?
That was later.
Yeah, that was later. But we wrote another song that was really a good one. Let's see, it was a parody on one of those religious hymns, of course. Let's see if I can recall that one.
You mean Hallelujah, I'm Drunk?
Oh, that dates even back before Joe Hill. That song dates back to the time of Coxey's Army.
Sure.
But of course, when Radio Mac began to get become a little bit too bourgeois conscious to my notion. In other words, when he was a radio star, why? He massacred, you know, Hallelujah, I'm a Bum song. In other words, his version of the I'm a Bum song is not the original version at all. The original version was, why don't you work like other men do? How in hell can I work when there's no work to do? And then in mock derision, you know, Hallelujah, I'm a bum. Hallelujah, bum again. Hallelujah, give us a handout to revive us again. The only part that Radio Mac. That song dates back to. I remember one night I was browsing through Carl Sandburg's song bag. And I spotted any. Excuse me a moment, it's getting a little bit chilly. I spotted any odd number of songs in Carl Sandburg's song bag that dated back beyond. Around about 1850 and even further back than that, you know, Ben. That's one thing about the American workers. They, a good many of this new generation aren't of hundreds of thousands of them, millions of them aren't aware of the militant, background and this country's labor movement has. You take some of the old timers are still living that can remember the old ARU, you know, the American Railway Union, and Eugene Victor Debs, and before that the American Labor Union, which was a forerunner, I understand, of the Western Federation. That's where the Western Federation of Miners, I think, stemmed from, wouldn't it, Ben?
American Labor Union was before the Civil War, around that period.
Yeah.
And William Silvers. But the whole background of American labor is militant until the AFL came on the scene. And the AFL, if you dug into the history of the separate craft unions and their struggles, you find plenty of the local militancy and plenty of militancy in part of the rank and file. But the official position was very different, and the officialdom of the AFL became a very conservative thing. But the Knights of Labor was a the Knights of Labor was a mass union of the working class with definite socialistic principles in its preamble and platform or whatever they...
Even the United Brewery Workers, when it was a part of the AFL, in its preamble, stated that that the final aim of organized labor was the abolition of the capitalist system and the building of a working class republic. A good many people aren't aware of that fact, but that's the truth.
Well. Are you still down in Fresno, or did
the history of the organization.
A lot of them stuck around Fresno afterwards?
Well, they ran most of us out by virtue of the fact that we were blacklisted. It was virtually impossible for most of us to get employment around Fresno. They'll tell you that the blacklist doesn't exist these days, but in at that time it was a reality. I couldn't get a job with that.
Frank Little's niece, Virginia, she was in Fresno last
year. And at that time,
she was up here for a while and stayed in my house out at the beach for about 4 weeks. And went back. Frank Little's niece, yeah, she went back to Fresno. Her family lives in Fresno, and then she got married, and she was still living in Fresno, and that was in the late 30s. So there may be some of them around there still.
I think the last time I was down in Fresno, I think was 1947. I was visiting a friend of mine, Louis Lieberman. I don't know if you knew him or not. And Mrs. Lieberman told me that Fred Little, that is Frank's brother, and his wife were still living in the outskirts of Fresno. The best characterization I've ever read of the AFL was they wanted Oscar, you remember Oscar Ammeringer, don't you? Boy, he had a pen, you know, that he could write with an acid pen, you know.
He didn't write in his autobiography, though. I was disappointed in that. Well, he didn't let it go.
But this characterization he gave of the AFL, though, Bennett, was wonderful. He pictures, you know, the way the craft unionists, the way they scab on each other, you know, and beat the other fellows' economic brains out, you know, through their treachery, you know, in a craft union sense, and their labor fakers, you know, selling them out. Oscar Ammeringer put it like this. He has the labor faker, you know, speaking. He says, "My dear brother, I am sorry to be under contract to hang you, but I know it will please you to hear that the scaffold was built by union labor. The rope bears the label, and brother, here is my card." "My dear brother, I am sorry to be under contract to hang you, but I know it will please you to hear that the scaffold was built by union labor. The rope bears the label, and here's my union." Oh, well, look, in 1910, when the Harriman system, shopmen, you know, the machinists and boilermakers and the car knockers and all the rest of them were out on strike on the Harriman system, believe it or not, union carpenters were the ones that built the stockade around the shop there for